Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really fascinating legal knot from back in 1961, the New Mexico Supreme Court case, Yucca Mining v. Phillips Oil Co. Now, I know maybe not the most thrilling title you've ever heard, but honestly, stick with us. This case gives a surprisingly relevant look at how courts have to balance, the formal paperwork of contracts with what actually happens day to day in business.
Exactly. It's that classic tension, written word versus real world actions.
Think of it as a crucial lesson. What happens when the signed agreement bumps up against the unspoken understanding?
Right. And for you law students listening in, this deep dive, it's pure gold. Seriously. You read about concepts like waiver, estoppel, oral modifications in your textbooks,
Yeah,
right?
they can feel pretty abstract.
Well, this case takes those abstract ideas and slams them right down into a tangible dispute. It shows you exactly how they play out in a courtroom and, importantly, how they impact a real business outcome.
Okay, so let's set the stage a bit. The initial deal, it was between Yucca Mining and Phillips Oil. Pretty straightforward. Yucca paid Phillips $12,000.
Yep, 12 grand.
And Phillips was supposed to use that to drill two oil wells on an existing oil lease that Phillips held.
Right, on Phillips' land, essentially.
And the terms, they seem pretty clear on paper. If both wells came up dry, no oil, the whole arrangement would basically just
end.
Wrap up, exactly. And at that point, Phillips had two key obligations. Assign Yucca a 50% interest in that lease, and provide a detailed accounting of how they spent that $12,000. Simple enough, right? Seems clear.
Yeah, on the surface, a seemingly straightforward agreement, outlining exactly what each party had to do. But, well, as we often see in the business world, things happen. Unforeseen events, they can complicate even the clearest contracts.
And that's what happened here. The first, just like the contract allowed for, turned out to be dry. No oil. But Phillips didn't immediately follow through. They didn't assign that 50% lease interest to Yucca. And they didn't provide that financial breakdown, that accounting.
Ah, okay. So that's the first deviation from the script, from the written plan.
Right. And here's where it gets really interesting, where the conflict really heats up. Instead of just stopping after that first dry well, like the contract kind of implied they should, Phillips went ahead and drilled a second well. But, and this is the crucial part, it wasn't on the original lease land at all.
Oh, where was it?
They drilled on a completely different piece of land. A place where Phillips only had the rights to drill, but they didn't actually own the lease itself.
I see. So a different location entirely,
yeah,
with different ownership implications.
Exactly. And the result of this second attempt, well, you can probably guess.
Another dry hole.
Bingo. Another dry hole.
Okay. So from Yucca's point of view, Phillips has now really gone off script. They didn't do the assignment after well number one, and then they drilled well number two somewhere else entirely.
Yeah, you can see why Yucca would be thinking, hold on, this isn't what we agreed to. They concluded, pretty obviously, that Phillips had failed to uphold their end of the bargain.
Makes sense from their perspective.
Now, Phillips didn't just, throw up their hands. They had a counter-argument, and it's absolutely central to why this case is still worth digging into today.
Okay, what was their defense?
Phillips claimed that key executives at Yucca, like the president, their geologist, had verbally agreed to this change in location for the second well.
Ah, the oral modification argument.
Exactly. They basically said, look, Yucca knew about it. Their main guys were involved in picking the spot. They were on board.
Right.
But Yucca pushed back hard. They denied any such agreement. They insisted that, look, according to our own rules, only our full board of directors had the authority to approve any significant changes to a legally binding contract like this.
So a classic standoff. The formality of the written contract and corporate procedure versus these alleged informal spoken understandings between key people.
Precisely. And you can see how those abstract legal principles, waivers, estoppel, oral modification, suddenly become very, very concrete.
Yeah, the whole case really hinges on whether that supposed oral agreement to drill elsewhere was legally binding, and also what were the actual consequences of Phillips not assigning the lease and not giving the accounting after that first dry well were those major failures.
So naturally, it ended up in court. The case went to trial. And maybe a bit surprisingly, given that clear written contract, the trial court actually ruled in favor of Phillips.
Interesting. Yeah, that might raise an eyebrow initially. So what was the trial court's logic? How did they justify siding with Phillips?
Well, the trial court made several key findings. Primarily, they concluded that the original agreement had effectively been modified, not in writing, but through a sort of mutual understanding.
So they bought Philip's argument about the verbal agreement. Essentially, yes. They pointed specifically to the fact that Yucca's president and their geological consultant weren't just, like, passively aware of the plan for the second rel and the different property. They were actively involved in the planning.
Actively involved? How so?
Well, presumably, discussing locations, reviewing data, giving input. The court reasoned that this level of knowledge and participation implied that Yucca, through these representatives, had accepted the change, even without a formal, you know, rubber-stamped amendment approved by the entire board.
Okay, so the court looked at the actions of Yucca's key people and said, that looks like agreement. What about the other issue? Phillips not assigning the lease interest or providing the accounting after the first dry well.
Right, that was the other part of Yucca's complaint. But the trial court concluded that this particular failure by Phillips didn't actually cause any significant harm or prejudice to Yucca.
How did they figure that? It was in the contract.
Their logic was pretty pragmatic. Since both wells ended up being dry, that 50% interest in the original oil lease, well, it essentially became worthless. Ah, okay, so no oil means the lease has no value.
Exactly. So while Phillips technically did fail to fulfill that specific requirement of the original contract, the ultimate outcome of valueless lease meant that Yucca didn't suffer any real financial loss because of that specific breach.
I see. So a technical breach, maybe, but no actual damages resulted from it. Did the court also consider if Yucca had complained about it at the time?
That's a good point. The ruling implies that if Yucca didn't raise a big stink about the missing assignment or accounting right after the first dry well, it kind of weakened their later claim that it was a huge deal material breach.
Right. Their silence or inaction could be interpreted as acceptance, or at least not seeing it as critical at the time.
So, summarizing the trial court, they saw an implied agreement to change the second well's location based on Yucca's actions, and they downplayed the failure to assign the lease because, well, it turned out to be worthless anyway.
Okay. But Yucca wasn't happy with that.
Not at all. They weren't satisfied. Which is why they took the fight higher. They appealed the decision to the highest court in New Mexico, the state Supreme Court.
Makes sense. They likely argued the trial court got it wrong, that there wasn't real consent to the change, and that Phillips's failures were significant breaches.
Exactly. They put it all on the line arguing those points. This appeal sets the stage for the Supreme Court's decision, which, interestingly, ended up upholding the trial court's ruling. Again, finding in favor of Phillips.
Wow, so the Supreme Court agreed with the lower court. That's a pretty strong confirmation of the trial judge's view. What were the main legal pillars supporting the Supreme Court's decision?
The Supreme Court's affirmation really leaned on a few fundamental legal principles. The most prominent, the real star of the show, was equitable estoppel.
Okay, estoppel. Break that down in this context.
The court really hammered this point. Yucca's president and there are other representatives who were clearly acting for the company, they had full knowledge of the plan to drill the second well at the new location. Not only knew, but actively participated in the planning and the execution.
Right, the active involvement again.
And crucially, they did all this without raising any objections. They didn't say, hey, wait, this isn't per the contract. This silence, combined with the active involvement, led the Supreme Court to say, basically, Yucca couldn't later turn around and claim this location change was a breach of contract.
So you can't watch something happen, help it happen, and then cry foul later.
Exactly. Think of it like this for everyone listening. If you see a change happening in a deal you're part of, and you actively participate in that change without protesting, you generally lose the right to later say you didn't agree to it. It's the law stepping in to prevent someone from going back on their word or actions, especially when the other party relied on that apparent agreement. No gotcha tactics allowed.
That makes intuitive sense, really. It promotes fairness. You can't just lay in the weeds.
Right. It undermines the whole idea of good faith dealing if you could do that.
Yeah.
So that covers the location change. What about Phillips' other slip-up, not assigning that lease interest to Yucca?
On that point, the Supreme Court basically echoed the trial court. They agreed that the failure to assign that half interest in the oil lease did not constitute a material breach of the contract.
Okay, material is the key word there, isn't it?
Absolutely crucial. A minor hiccup or a failure to follow every single tiny detail of a contract doesn't automatically give the other side the right to just tear up the whole agreement and walk away.
It needs to be something significant.
Yes, a material breach is a significant violation. It has to go to the very heart, the core purpose of the agreement. In this specific case, because both wells were dry, the lease itself had no real economic value. It was worthless.
Back to the worthless lease point.
Exactly. Therefore, Phillips's failure to hand over a 50% share of something worthless didn't actually cause any real financial harm to Yucca. The court also noted, importantly, that Yucca's own representatives had apparently approved the expenses related to the drilling.
Ah, so they were okaying the bills for the work being done.
Right. Which further weakened Yucca's argument that Phillips had somehow acted improperly or against their wishes. It's hard to argue someone breached a contract by doing work you approved the payment for.
Okay, let me try to quickly recap the Supreme Court's main points then. First, Yucca was basically blocked, a stop from complaining about the second well's location because their own key people knew about it, were involved, and didn't object.
Check. Equitable estoppel in action.
And second, the failure to assign the worthless lease wasn't a material breach. It wasn't significant enough legally to blow up the whole deal, especially since Yucca suffered no actual financial loss from that specific failure and had approved the expenses.
Precisely. You've nailed the core reasoning. In this case, it really serves as a powerful illustration of some fundamental contract law principles that are still incredibly relevant today.
Like what? What are the big takeaways for us?
Well, one of the most significant, I think, especially for those involved in business deals, is that oral modifications to written contracts can be legally binding.
Even without a new signed paper.
Yes, particularly when the actions of the parties clearly show they both agreed to the changes. Even if those changes aren't formally documented, you know, signed, sealed, delivered, or approved by the full board, as Yucca argued was necessary, the court here looked beyond the strict text of the original agreement to the actual behavior of Yucca's representatives.
That's a really, really crucial point. You could have the most perfectly drafted contract in the world, but if your subsequent conduct, your actions, suggest you've agreed to do something different.
That conduct can have serious legal consequences. It can effectively change the deal.
Wow. Okay. What else?
Well, that leads directly to the second key principle we've been talking about, equitable estoppel. As we saw, your silence when you should speak up, or your active participation in something that deviates from the contract, can mean you waive your right to object later.
You lose your right to complain.
Essentially, yes. If you're aware of a change, you don't voice your concerns promptly, and maybe you even participate in the new way of doing things, a court is very likely to prevent you, stop you from later claiming a breach based on that very change you seem to accept through your actions or inaction.
Got it. And the third principle.
The third big one is the materiality of breach. We touched on this. It's not every little mistake or failure to follow every single clause that lets the other party just walk away.
It has to be a big deal.
It has to be significant enough to fundamentally undermine the whole purpose of the contract. Like in Yucca, the non-assignment, while technically not following the original terms, just didn't meet that high threshold of materiality because the underlying asset, that oil lease, had zero actual value. No harm, no foul, in a sense.
Okay, that makes sense. Materiality is key.
Exactly. And there's one more really important angle here. The court's view on the statute of frauds.
Ah, right. The rule that certain contracts, like those involving real estate, need to be in writing. An oil lease sounds like it involves real estate interests.
It absolutely does. So Yucca could have potentially argued, hey, any change to this deal involving the lease needed to be in writing to be valid under the statute of frauds.
But the court didn't go for that.
No, they specifically declined to let the statute of frauds be used essentially as a weapon by Yucca in this situation. The court made a very strong statement, famously saying that the statute of frauds shouldn't cause injustice.
That's a powerful quote. Statute of frauds shouldn't cause injustice. What does that really mean in this context?
It means that the primary purpose of the statute of frauds is to prevent fraud, like someone falsely claiming a contract exists. It's not meant to be used rigidly to create an unfair result. So if one party, like Phillips here, reasonably relied on an oral modification.
Believing Yucca's execs were on board with the new well location.
Exactly. And if enforcing the strict terms of the original written agreement, requiring the original location, would lead to a really unfair or unconscionable outcome for Phillips, like maybe not getting paid for the second well they drilled in good faith.
Then the court can step in.
Then the court has the power to say, no, we're not going to let the statute of frauds create an injustice here. They can enforce the oral modification despite the lack of writing, especially where one party acted on it. In Yucca, Phillips drilled that second well based on what they perceived as agreement from Yucca's key people. allowing Yucca to then hide behind the lack of a formal written change to potentially avoid paying, would have struck the court as fundamentally unfair.
So fairness and the practical reality of reliance trumped the strict writing requirement in this specific situation. It's a really valuable insight. Contract law isn't always just about the four corners of the document.
Precisely. It shows the law often tries to achieve a just result based on the overall conduct and reliance of the parties. In this case, Yucca, it continues to be significant for modern contract law.
How so? What are the modern implications?
Well, it really underscores the reality that contracts aren't always these static, unchanging documents. They can, and often do, evolve based on the conduct and the mutual understandings that develop between the parties as they work together.
Business realities can shape the legal reality.
Yes. It also highlights that even within big companies with clear internal rules and hierarchies, the actions of key officers, people with authority, can indeed bind the company legally. Especially if the company knows what the officer is doing and doesn't step in to stop it or correct it.
So internal protocols matter, but what actually happens on the ground matters too.
Definitely. It's a critical reminder that while, yes, having clear internal procedures and documenting everything formally is vital best practice, the courts will also look closely at the practical realities of the business interactions and apply principles of fairness like estoppel.
So bringing it all home, what's the number one key takeaway for our listeners, especially those law students out there?
For you future legal eagles, Yucca Mining v. Phillips Oil Co. is really a powerful cautionary tale. It just hammers home the absolute importance of clearly documenting all modifications to contracts. Get it in writing.
Amen to that.
And just as importantly, it emphasizes the critical need to object promptly and clearly if you believe the other party is deviating from the agreed upon terms. Don't sit on your rights.
Speak up. Or potentially lose your chance.
Exactly. Yucca's situation is a vivid illustration of how failures in internal communication, maybe not having clear processes for change approval, and definitely a lack of timely objection can lead to significant and really adverse legal consequences, even for a major company.
That's a really insightful closing point. It definitely makes you wonder, doesn't it? How might things have been different if Yucca had had, say, clearer internal comms, maybe stricter procedures for okaying contract changes, or if someone had just immediately followed up on why that lease assignment wasn't made after the first dry well.
Could have completely changed the outcome.
Yeah. Might have avoided the whole court battle. Definitely something for all of us, especially future lawyers and business leaders, to think about. Well, thanks for taking this deep dive with us today.
My pleasure. It's a great case to dissect.
Until our next exploration.